will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
People said, well, don't sweat the small things. Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to another in the series of our podcast regarding the history of Silicon Valley. This is a fun series for me. I'm enjoying doing it. It's causing me to have a lot of senior moments, trying to remember back all the things that I need to cover in this podcast. So I'm glad you're bearing with us as we slog our way through this. Anyway, with me today, I have Peter Marchetti, who's a personal wealth advisor for a bank. And grateful to have Peter Marchetti here with us. And also Guy Smith, who's my director of marketing for Tough Things First. So hello, everyone. And welcome, Peter and Guy, back to their podcast.
Great to be here,
Ray.
Okay, so let's talk about, as we now move into the 90s, kind of what the landscape was looking like. Silicon Valley's really taken off. I mean, it was getting a lot of momentum, a lot of companies going public, a lot of semiconductor companies that are really rocking and rolling. Again, I want to emphasize that almost all the semiconductor companies had their own wafer fabrication facilities. So the offshoring of wafer fabrication really hadn't taken off much in the early 90s. So the big driver now for semiconductors, as we now start into the 90s, were cell phones. And so Motorola, of course, was the big cheese doing it. You had Ericsson, Nokia, but Motorola was the big guy. They were the big gun in doing cell phones. But a lot of other companies were trying to get into cell phones too. BlackBerry or what's that? Something Research was the name of
Research
them.
In Motion, huh? RIM.
Research in Motion,
Research
right.
Research in Motion, RIM.
Right, they were getting into it with the BlackBerry and a little different approach. Qualcomm was jumping in the fray. They developed a protocol called CDMA, code division multiple access. Okay, code division multiple access. And that was something that Motorola was fighting, because Motorola was TDMA, time division multiplexing. Qualcomm was having a hard time. I mean, they were slogging it out, and so they managed to get their foothold into South Korea with Samsung, and that really helped launch Micrel, my company, because they needed power management, because we needed to. Because the early cell phones were gigantic. I mean, they were, you had the transceiver in the trunk of your car, and antenna was about 9 feet tall, and it was like a telephone. And that was what, we didn't even call it a cell phone, we called it a mobile phone. But up comes the cell phone, and these cell phone towers are being put up, and you had to have certain protocol to operate on those cell phone towers. Samsung was jumping in with both feet, and that really, the cell phones really launched Micrel, because the power management requirements for cell phones was just gigantic. So we kind of hitched our wagon to the CDMA, to Qualcomm. And in fact, we were in Qualcomm's very first cell phone. It was quite a ride, as you would. And then after Qualcomm started selling their cell phones, that then encouraged Samsung, because now Samsung had a launching platform that they could use to, because they wanted to compete with Motorola. When Samsung jumped in, of course, they lowered the price, and they were able to get a real good foothold in cell phones. And that began the beginning of the end, as you would have Motorola, because Motorola was by far the big dog in cell phones. So anyway, that's kind of the launching ground, as you would have, of Mike Krell's really entry into power management.
Well, an interesting parallel story there was the personal digital assistant market during the 1990s. Yeah. You saw things like the Apple Newton and the Palm Pilot. This was a key push in making things smaller and lighter, and it was almost the bleeding edge before somebody had the bright idea to take that glass screen technology in the PDAs and then merge them with a phone. And that, you know, was pretty much the idea behind the iPhone.
That's interesting, because that's exactly a good point, Guy, because that's interesting, because the PDA, the personal digital assistant, was a precursor really to the smartphone. And because, you know, the original phones were not smart at all. They were just telephones. Every single PDA company, I think, is now out of business.
The phone became the PDA.
Exactly. So that's one you don't learn to pivot. See, here's an example of people not knowing how to pivot, because the cell phone companies pivoted into the PDA, whereas the PDA companies did not pivot into the cell phone. As you pointed out, that really was the crux of why the PDA guys went out of business, because they couldn't pivot themselves into the cell phone market. So anyways, thanks. That's a good capture point.
I don't have a question about the PDAs versus cell phones, but how did the cell phone adoption was heavily dependent upon telecommunication and the network? Mm-hmm. I mean, how did that kind of play into it? Do you think like the development of the network led to the further growth of the cell phone, or do you think it was vice versa? And how did Mike Rell play into that as well?
Well, I think the cell phone market did launch the internet, because they go hand in hand. You've made a good segue for me to talk about that next product area, which is all the products associated with the internet. You know, the internet came into being at about the same time frame in the middle 90s. That really sent the digital home, it set it really in motion, was the internet. A lot of companies then jumped on making gateways and routers and all those products as we now entered into what we call the dot-com era. So the dot-com era, which is again parallel with the cell phone market, really was the beginning of the growth of cell software and other products outside of the semiconductor area. So you had, you know, these outside foundries were all getting set up in Taiwan and Korea and Japan, China started putting in these wafer foundries. And these guys that were just designers, they weren't semiconductor guys, were able to build products that were very intelligent, very, very sophisticated, because they had access to very, very good technology, wafer fab technology outside of the US. And I think that probably really launched, as you would, the dot-com era. Was the ability for companies to, like Broadcom and others, to use outside foundries with their designs to really enter the telecommunication space, and that was really I think a real strong growth area for the entire Silicon Valley environment.
I think you're spot on there, because one of the things in the early days of the commercialization of the internet, to misquote somebody else, they said at this particular point in time in the 90s, we're just crouched around the fire in our loincloths chewing on chicken bones. We don't know what the internet is. We don't know where it's going. We don't know what we can do with it. So going to the fabless model so that people could continue to experiment with chip designs without that massive upfront cost of setting up your own fab, I think was the thing that turned a lot of Silicon Valley into a chip incubator. In other words, a lot of people could get into the game and develop very niche products that would have never been developed before if it had had that upfront capital cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Marvell and Broadcom and Avago so many others were able to do that without having these $100 billion wafer fabs. What's interesting is that the big gun in telecommunication was Nortel, N-O-R-T-E-L, is a Canadian company, and they are no longer in business because the dot-com implosion did them in. But they were growing like crazy. I mean, all these fiber lines were being put in. These real expensive and gateways, cloud computing, all that began to really spread rapidly. You had Apple beginning to grow and get some traction, as well as other very large electronic companies. AT&T started really, getting involved. Ericsson in Sweden, and of course Germany with Telefunken. You had these huge telecommunication companies really began to boom during this time period. What I'd like to end on today is really talk about what really caused this what they call the dot-com implosion. The dot-com era began in probably the mid-90s. And it was just growing like crazy. We were seeing under Bill Clinton, the push for the just telecommunication capability, internet and so forth, became a real launching point for him. What happened was is that the growth was so spectacular that that companies were double ordering. We're seeing a little bit of that now, even today, and with this coronavirus pandemic. We're seeing a little bit of that happening in the semi space. And I'm feared we're going to have the repeat of the dot-com implosion if we don't watch and are not careful.
On that, Ray, what areas do you think, just a little bit of a segue, but what areas do you think right now are kind of getting a little bit overheated or there's more purchasing than is maybe fundamentally needed right now?
Well, the semi space is getting overheated because the inventories are way down. Like they were back in the time period we're talking about, the 90s, the inventories are very, very low because we weren't prepared for this rapid growth that we saw prior to Y2K, which is the turning of the 21st century. People were getting scared to death. They thought there was this conspiracy theory believing that somehow or another something was going to happen and we were going to lose all this. Some explosion was going to happen, which did happen, but more of a financial explosion. And so people ordering like crazy, they're ordering tons and tons of stuff. So there was about 30% more demand. I mean, more apparent demand than there was real demand. So people start gearing up like crazy to meet the demand. Well, you have the similar problem now. With the coronavirus, inventories are way down because of what happened a year ago. The layoffs and plants shutting down, and so the inventories are extremely low right now in the semi space. I know we're getting off our discussion, but they're very similar. So the coronavirus pandemic is actually looking a lot like the dot-com implosion. So when the economy turns back around again, everything is kind of back to normal. You're going to see excess inventories. You're going to actually see the same thing that happened in 2002, 2003, when the industry imploded. So we need to watch for that. We need to be careful that doesn't repeat itself. History has a tendency, by the way, to repeat itself. And I kind of see that potential in the next 18 months.
I kind of agree with you. Whenever I see a lot of people being stupid simultaneously, it's usually a bad sign. And back during the 90s, because the internet was such a new thing to so many people, everyone was in a gold rush mentality. They were putting bets down on every company that sprang to life who said they could make a buck on the internet. And my, I still think the poster child is Webvan. For the younger people in the audience, Webvan was a company that came to life saying that you can use the internet to order your groceries and they'll be delivered to your house. And they raked in tons and tons and tons of capital investment, which went up in a puff of smoke because they didn't take the time to understand the actual demand or the mechanics of what it was going to take to deliver groceries. And that was, they are really the epitome of that gold rush mentality that leads a lot of people to sink their money into operations they'll never get their money out of.
Well, again, they raised a ton of money, over $400 million. And they just went, they didn't just give the money back to the investors. They spent every dime of it, but they were the kind of the precursor. If you know that Amazon has acquired Whole Foods, and they're doing basically what Webvan did. They just, Webvan just didn't have the physical resources to really implement their idea, even though Webvan is basically what Amazon is doing now with Whole Foods and other companies like Walmart and Safeway and others. You can now get your food delivered to your door. What's that? DoorDash is another company that delivers food and delivers product directly to your door. But you know, getting back about so we can end this particular podcast. As we entered Y2K or entered this next century, 2000. You know, the demand looked like it was off the rails, but it really wasn't. In other words, the supply now began to far exceed demand. So we were growing, our eyes were bigger than our stomach. And in the early 2000s, you saw this implosion where the whole dot-com space just totally blew up. A lot of people lost their jobs, lost companies, went out of business like Nortel. It was a disaster. I mean, the dot-com was a disaster. And what I'm worried about and concerned about is the pandemic could be a follow-on or sequel to what happened in 2000. So we're only talking 20 years. So look at this, two decades later, we're facing a similar type problem. Okay, guys, thank you for this segment. And again, we're going to move into the 21st century as we begin to talk about how we came out of the dot-com implosion and kind of where we're going over the next 20 years. So thank you for being here with this guy and Peter for this segment. Appreciate your comments and ideas. I'm sorry if this is sounding so much like, a raise-in dialogue here, but I'm so excited about talking about Silicon Valley history that I kind of get carried away. So I apologize. So read my book, Tough Things First. That's a good textbook for those of you who want to start your own company. My book, Zen of Zen, and my new book, Zen is in 2, which will be out here in another 4 months. So thanks again, Peter and Guy, for joining us. Look forward to meeting with you guys next time.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.